Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Tori Ritchie, cookbook author and teacher, and we're also welcoming today our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealth.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our guest today, the distinguished Kathleen Weber, owner and baker at Della Fattoria in Petaluma. Did you like that little Italian inflection?
I loved it.
Were you impressed with that? Careful of local
really
Californians.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So, now, Kathleen, yes. I could introduce you, which I just did, which you are, as the proprietor of the very beloved Della Fattoria up in Petaluma. I could say that you're a self-taught baker. I could say that your bakery has won many awards, and it's also been named one of America's 10 best bakeries by Bon Appetit magazine. And I could say that one of your very first customers was the esteemed Thomas Keller, chef of the French Laundry, and that, in fact, he wrote the foreword to your book. But that's not how I'm going to introduce you. I'm actually going to read to you, or to all of you, and to everyone listening, the words that the mother of a guy in my apartment building emailed me when she heard I was interviewing you, because she's known you for years.
Oh, my.
And this is what she wrote, having no idea, of course, that I would be laying this on all of you. She said, Kathleen is just so warm and giving, and it shows in her bread and the food at the restaurant. Only she could have fostered the talents of both family and other chefs to this extent. I don't know how she does it. This talking about herself will drive her nuts, since she never focuses on herself and her incredible talents.
Whoa.
And I think that's, you know, when I read your book, which I spent the weekend up in, I was up in Lake Tahoe this weekend, and I read through it, and it is a cover-to-cover read. I mean, I couldn't put it down, because you tell amazing stories about your life and how you came to this world of bread baking. And like all good stories, it has an amazing setting. So that's where I'd like to start. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about Weber Ranch.
So Weber Ranch is my husband's family's chicken ranch. And my father-in-law immigrated from Germany. And probably many of you know that Petaluma was sort of the egg basket, the egg capital of the world. We're especially known for our Jewish egg ranchers, but they actually came from everywhere. And at one point in the 50s, I would say the late 50s, the business had one of those forks in the road, like we've seen recently, where you either got really big, which his cousin did, or you got out, which they did. So they stopped producing eggs, except just for themselves, and then they turned the ranch. They moved houses onto it. Actually, there were some houses that were being torn down. Do you want to hear this whole thing?
Well, you married into this family.
I married into this family,
and you live there.
Yeah, we live there.
And you have raised your children there, and obviously a number of chickens still.
Still.
But how did you start baking bread there?
Well, that was later.
Okay. Well, let's fast forward.
Well, no, that wasn't later. I've always baked bread.
So you and your husband have lived on this ranch
for
40 years.
We live in the house he grew up in. Yes.
And it's there that you baked your first loaf of wood-fired bread.
It
and
is.
In the book, you talk about that moment. I think it was in about 1995. Is that correct?
96?
94. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, one of those years.
Yeah.
Those 90s.
True. One of those.
So you write about the fact that you'd been baking bread when you and your husband were newly
right.
married, and that, you know, your various friends were starving students, and they all loved the delicious bread. I did, word for word. And then you had this transformative moment in the mid-90s where, through kind of a funny story, which you can read about in the book, a wood-fired oven was built on Weber Ranch, on that property.
Right.
And
right outside our back door.
And then you baked in a wood-fired oven for the first time. So tell us about that experience.
Well, it was such a lifelong dream that actually being able to do it was amazing. Did I say something in the book about that?
Well, you
because
said yes.
I haven't read it since.
Well, I'll give you a clue. You were making bread for the first time with something called biga? Am I saying that right?
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, no, but I did that. That was earlier. That
okay.
was before the wood oven.
Yeah.
I have to tell you. But the
tell us what biga is and why it makes bread so great.
Well, biga is like a starter, except it's a very quick one. A biga is something you make with flour and water and a tiny, tiny bit of yeast. So it's actually a pre-ferment. It will add longevity to the bread. It'll help with its flavor. But it is a very magical. If you've only done yeasted breads, once you use a little biga, you are going to be over the moon, because suddenly that boring bread will have all this other dimension to it. It's going to have a better crust. It's going to have this beautiful open crumb. And you're going to be a hero, just as I was. And that's, you know, who doesn't want to be a hero?
And you learned about biga from another local legend, Carol Field.
My darling friend Carol Field, who is just, she knows, because this is the way it was for me when I first started baking. I was actually in the retail clothing business at that time. So at night when I would come home, I would make a biga. In the morning, I would start the dough. I would go off to work, and I'd come home, and I'd bake. I was an absolute fiend, and I couldn't I really couldn't stop. But I talked to Carol the whole time, not on the phone, because why would Carol ever want to talk to someone like me? I just talked to her in my head. Like, Carol, what would you do if this happened? And I'd get little answers, and I was happy with that.
Of course, in those days, you could have looked her up in the phone book and called her in San Francisco, and I bet she would have answered. She was so nice.
And she told me later, well, why didn't you call me, you silly girl? But I didn't, you know, I had just kind of an inflated opinion of cookbook authors, and believe me, I'm dissuaded of that now.
Yeah, now you know what hard work it is. It's not an easy thing. Yeah. So you made this bread with a starter called biga. So it's a sort of an overnight starter?
Yes.
And then you had the opportunity to then take it to the next level, which was to bake it in a wood-fired oven that your husband and sort of a crew of people, it's an interesting story, but we won't go into that. You built it on the property
we
and
did.
You baked your first wood-fired, because you are known for wood-fired breads.
That's our deal.
Yeah, that's your deal. Mm-hmm. So what was the first loaf you made?
The first loaf was a Pugliese, I believe. Very nice Italian bread.
Oh, wonderful. You still make a Pugliese, don't you?
We do. We just call it Campagna.
Yeah. Well,
because
I'll tell you
why we call it Campagna.
Okay.
It is, if you wanted to know our recipe, although it's in the book, if you wanted it before that, you would just look at Carol Field's book under Pugliese. But when we looked at getting bread to Thomas Keller for his restaurant, he wanted a Campagna. And I looked it up as best I could. In those days, there weren't so many. I don't think the internet was even around. I couldn't find so many references. So from what I could tell, a Pugliese and a Campagna were the same thing. So I made it into a batard and called it a Campagna. I said, here, Thomas.
Well, of course, all bread baking is built on years and years of learning someone else's recipe, like all good cooking.
Right. That's right.
So how did Thomas Keller enter the picture?
Ah, that is a good story. My son was cooking at Sonoma Mission Inn, and his then-girlfriend was applying to be a server at the French Laundry. And she passed her little meeting with Laura. You all know who Laura is if you know the French Laundry. And went on to Thomas. And she's meeting with Thomas, and she asks him during her interview to be hired, she asks him, who does your bread? And he told her, and she said, oh, well, maybe you'd like a really good bread.
And she said, my boyfriend's mother is baking amazing bread?
She was very clever. She didn't say that. She said, I'll put you in touch with some really good bread.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you get Thomas Keller calling you on the phone and saying, hi, I'd like 20 loaves of Campagna tomorrow night.
Right. Well, my husband Ed just walked in. We got a little stuck in traffic. But anyway, we dropped a basket off on his front door because his house is right next to the restaurant. And so we dropped a basket off, and he called me later and said, I like your bread.
Wow.
And that was it.
Wow.
So we started, you know, baking for him the next day. Actually.
And you were doing this all at the ranch in that wood-fired oven?
In a very small one.
Oh, uh-huh. Wow. Uh-huh. At what point did you establish a bakery in downtown Petaluma?
10 years later.
Oh, wow. So all those early years you were baking there at the ranch.
And we still do.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We've gone through several iterations of our ovens by now, but we have for the past, I would say 10 years, baked for about 30 customers. We maybe have 35 now, but we've kept it just kind of at that one little level because there's only so much bread you can bake out of a wood oven.
Well, and also, you know, you're not only legendary for the bakery in Petaluma, which is delicious, and I've been there for lunch several times, but, you know, you've had a stall at the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market that right. is a mob scene, and because everybody loves your bread so much. And then you also go to the Marin County Farmers Market
right.
as well, I believe.
Right, you do.
And so what was the first – well, you had Thomas Keller as a client, and then
right.
you must have gotten other chefs as well.
Right.
And then you started the stall at the farmer's market. And during, as your business is growing, my understanding is that it's really a family business in the way that, I mean, you started this as a hobby.
Right.
It exploded into a big business. But the beauty of the story, what I love, what gives it such a beautiful story arc, is that your whole family's involved. So you mentioned Ed, he's here, and your kids are involved.
Right.
Tell me
right.
about that.
Well, Aaron went from cooking at Sonoma Mission Inn to a little stint at the French Laundry. That was after our bread was there. And then he didn't quite cut the grade there. He was pretty young. So he went on to cook for Daniel Patterson at Babette's in Sonoma. Some of you know his first darling restaurant. And it was when he was working at Babette's that we started getting really overwhelmed. So he'd come home and help. He was living in Sonoma then, but he'd come home and help on the busier nights. He'd sleep. It was just so French. He had a little futon that was right next to the oven, which was right next to Ed's piano. So he'd sleep out there during the night until it was time to get up and start working on the bread.
Aww.
Yeah. And then our daughter was next door. She builds furniture, which she still does some of. But, you know, everybody kind of had to pitch in because we had no plan. This just was invented as we went along.
And is that still the
It is.
So
much to the dismay of many, it is.
Well, so with all of these things going on in your life, I have to ask you, what made you decide to write a cookbook now?
That's a really good question.
Because it is a lot of work.
That. Yeah. No one tells you that.
No one tells you that.
But, you know, I mean, I think to have a cookbook, you need to be able to address something that isn't addressed, that hasn't been handled out there already. And there really are a lot of bread books of late.
There are.
There certainly
weren't a phenomenon.
For a long time, but there were. But I honestly have to say there were two things that I was interested in addressing. One was I really think the model that we use is the little old Italian woman with the craggy fingers and the black dress who maybe doesn't even know how to read and write, but she knows how to bake bread. And she knows how to bake bread because her mother showed her how to bake bread. And they didn't weigh and they didn't do measurements. It was you put the bread in and then you added water till it felt right, and you put the starter in and you put the salt in and you mixed it until it was all something that felt right, and then you let it wait a while and then it went in the oven. It wasn't an intellectual endeavor, and I kind of feel like now it's gotten very, very, Chad is my best example. He calls himself a geek bread baker because
we're talking about tartine.
Chad Robertson. That's his. He just loves that part of it. And there's so many people out there who also love that. But then that might be a little scary for someone like me who wants to bake bread like those old women did.
So what you're communicating through the book is the intuitive sort of passed down, time worn wisdom of bread baking. Of course, you have to give recipes. And you do it in a very interesting way. But I'd like to talk about, because for as much as I've taught cooking and so forth, I cannot bake bread to save my life.
Oh, we can fix you.
Yeah. And I'm sure that many people in this room right now probably eat your bread and love your bread and think, wow, how could I ever do that at home? And walk us through the organization of the book, because the way you organized it is very unique.
Well, we kind of organized it as it evolved in my own personal life, starting with the very simple breads, the very simple yeasted breads. And I tried to find recipes that didn't show up everywhere, but that were interesting. So we start with the yeasted, and then we move on to the pre-ferments. And then we talk a little bit about enriched doughs. And the enriched means things like brioche and those doughs that have butter and egg and maybe some sugar in them. And then from there we went on to the naturally fermented breads, which are what we're known for and which are very, very easy to do.
So let's talk about the difference just between pre-ferment, mm-hmm. which you talked about before. So that biga, right. that starter, is a pre-ferment. So that's
Correct.
Kind of an overnight starter thing.
Right.
Right. Okay, so then what is naturally leavened bread?
Well, naturally leavened is bread that is baked with a little glob of stuff. And that stuff is water, flour, and your own natural microbes that appear in your very own kitchen. So while you could, I freely give my starter away, and people are always saying to me, well, aren't you giving away the family farm here, the jewels? Not really, because once that starter goes in your kitchen, it's going to take on your microbes, and it's going to work that way. So your bread will not taste or act exactly like mine does, but probably very similar.
So we are in San Francisco. It sounds
yes.
like sourdough.
Right.
Yeah,
it is sourdough.
But you don't call it sourdough because it's not sour.
Well, because we keep ours from being sour. We could allow it to become sour by making it by changing the conditions. We could make it wetter. We could make it longer between feedings. We could do all kinds of things to make it more sour, but my personal preference is a nutty flavor. I like to taste the wheat. I like to taste, I know wheat's a bad word for some people, but I like to taste the wheat. And so we keep it very dry, kind of like a biscuit dough, and that helps keep it from going to the sour part.
So this, I mean, it's a living thing. You're talking about
living.
A living thing here. So you have a sort of a combination of flour and water and no yeast for these natural ferments.
No commercial yeast.
No leavener. No leavener.
No commercial
yeah.
yeast.
Okay.
Because the yeast is in those microbes that are in our kitchen.
Ah, right. Okay. okay. Right. So you're not adding commercial yeast
Never.
To it. The natural yeast in the environment around you,
right.
and no matter and depending on where you live and,
right.
and what season it is, even will change the flavor.
It could. Ours is pretty consistent right
mm-hmm.
now. I mean, baking bread the way we do, I will tell you that there are variables that you have to consider every day. When the weather changes, like right now, suddenly it's humid, that will definitely impact our bread because we're already baking, although our starter is very firm, our bread is very wet. So we bake with a hydration of between 80 and 90, even 95% water. So on a day like this, when suddenly it's wet, and damp, then we're going to have to back off on that. Did I go?
Yeah.
I didn't answer
you did.
That, did I?
No, you did. I mean, and I think it's, you know, we might be getting a little technical for,
right.
But that's the thing about your book. I mean, first of all, when I read through it this weekend, I thought to myself, this is the best progression. You start with the basic yeast, then
right.
once you've mastered that, then you can try a little bit more complex versions of that, which would be the enriched breads, which, you know, you mentioned brioche and
right,
things
right.
that, and those are very slippery breads. I have worked
they
with this.
Slippery.
But then getting, and I've, you know, getting into pre-ferment, which is working with a starter, that seems somewhat familiar. But the naturally leavened one is really where the fascination lies and really where the individualization lies and really what you're known for is the flavor and texture of these wet breads means that the crumb inside is very tender and very moist, right?
Right.
And the crust. So you give a great tip in the book, which is that I hadn't heard before, which is you do bake a lot of these breads in the book. There's 63 recipes, and many of them are baked in, let's call them molds. Some are bread
sure.
pans.
Right.
Some are you use the enameled iron pot a lot.
We do.
Right. So talk about that. Talk about shaping the breads and what we can use at home as these vessels.
I honestly, you can bake bread in almost anything. But the iron pots are really pretty wonderful, as are clay pots. But iron, if you get that nice and hot, there's two ways to do it. Do you want this?
Yeah, yeah.
There's two
I think
ways
you
to
want.
Do it.
They want it. The audience.
You want
yeah.
You can heat the pot up, in your oven and then put the cold dough, transfer it from a basket into that hot pot. Or you can be, you can also, I found accidentally, because I forgot to heat it up once, you can put that, you can actually put the dough into the pot cold, as not cold in the refrigerator, but you can put it into a not heated pot and have it just do beautifully. So it's very, what happens is that pot gives it its environment, and it doesn't allow that moisture to escape. If we're gonna bake these wet doughs in a wood oven or in your oven with clay tiles on it, you're gonna have to spray water in there to keep the moisture going and to keep it from a skin forming on it or a crust before it has its full jump, as they say. So, but when you do it in a pan with a lid on it, all the moisture is right there. So it's got.
Oh, you
its
do
own
it with a lid on it.
Well, you can.
Oh, wow!
Yes.
Interesting.
You can do it without that, but wow. You but best with the lid on. Then it's got its own its little incubator, and it's just its happy little environment, and it stays moist and gets a beautiful crust on it. At one point, when you go to, I've not found this with every pot, but with most of them. About 3/4 through, I'll take the lid off so it can finish browning. And you look at it, and it just looks like a wet bird. It looks like a thing that's lost its feathers. It looks just kind of like embarrassed for it. But then you put it back in the oven, and it just browns beautifully, and it's wonderful.
You also say in several of the recipes to actually take them out of their mold at the last, you know, when the bread is done, and we'll get back to that fact, but
right.
When the bread is done, to actually remove them from their molds and put them back in the oven for about 3 to 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Tell us
well,
about that.
Things, bread that's baked in, for instance, a Pullman pan, which is your regular little bread loaf pan, sometimes they don't brown nicely on the sides and on the bottom, but they're really brown on top and they're ready to go by the top. So you don't want to have a bread that looks pale and pasty on the bottom and golden brown on top. So you just flip it out of its container and let it be on the stone for a while, maybe on its side, and then flip it over in the other side.
And
finish browning, just to finish browning and get a nice crisp.
That's a great tip. And so you highly recommend that the home baker has a baking stone, and you actually you don't put that on the bottom of the oven. You put it on the rack?
We put it on the rack.
And
we,
even when the bread is in a container like a pan, you put the pan right on the stone.
We do everything in the oven with that. I mean, I leave it on if I'm going to do cookies, if we're going to do a roast, whatever. That just stays in the oven. And in all honesty, in the early days, we did put it on the bottom of the oven, but the oven manufacturers, well, our original oven is a 1930s Magic Chef commercial oven with absolutely no insulation. And it kind of didn't care what we did. But new ovens are a little bit fussier. So the manufacturers don't want you to put that stone right on the bottom.
We heard
from someone who was doing a repair. So of course we can't recommend that in the book. But if you want to try it.
Yeah, because the stone
disclaimer
time. Excuse me, I have to read a station break. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Kathleen Weber talk about her life and career. She is the founder of Della Fattoria in Petaluma. Hey, I want to ask you about the name. I hear you were going to call it First You Chop Wood.
Uh-huh. First You Chop the Wood. Well, we wanted everyone to know.
Okay, that's the first step in bread baking. How did you end up with the name Della Fattoria?
I read a book by Elizabeth Romer called The Tuscan Year.
Oh, it's one of my all-time favorite books.
Do you
books.
Love that, too?
I do.
I knew we had a lot of things
Oh, God,
in common.
I love that book.
It's
an obscure book, and I got it in the 80s, and I teach it
yes.
in all my classes.
Do you?
I do.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, then you know. I mean,
but
just
they
reading,
don't.
Well, oh, sorry, Tori. Just reading that book and the lifestyle of these people, and I just thought, you know, this is what we do here. We have a lifestyle that is around our farm. We don't get to go on vacations very much. We're busy. We're happy. We're preparing food. We've got our garden. We're doing all these things. And Della Fattoria means from the farm. And as in Elizabeth's book, she constantly talks about the fattoria. So
There you go. Della Fattoria.
Della Fattoria
means from the farm. Right. In Italian.
We're of the farm.
You call it or of the farm. You call you nickname it Della also, right? Isn't that
a few times? Our customers did that.
Oh. Mm. Yeah. So they just call it Della.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of happiness on the farm, one of I don't know how many people know this, but I have actually been to one of your farm dinners in the summer, and it's so fabulous. So it's a way for people to actually get their foot on Weber Ranch and see it. Tell us about those.
Well, it's secret, though, you know.
Oh, yeah, well, hello, world. It's on your website.
It's a great little word-of-mouth thing, but we do dinners every Saturday in the summer, and my son cooks, my daughter sets the stage, and, you know, she creates a magical environment, I have to say. It's quite, every year, there's just a little more glitz added to it. It's somewhere between a gypsy wagon and a Moroccan tour bus right now. But it is great fun. The food is delicious. And you get to watch the baking happen. And for reasons that I can't even understand or describe, people kind of just let their shoulders drop when they get on the ranch. They just kind of go, oh, okay. This is nothing fussy. It's nothing special. We're just going to relax. And they seem to, and they talk, and they talk to strangers, which, of course, I love. And it's a great time.
It is. I can tell you because I've been there. It's fantastic. Okay, so now you can experience your bread. Everyone here can experience your breads by buying them. You sell them commercially in Northern California at farmers markets. There's the bakery and cafe in downtown Petaluma. There's this secret about secret dinners. But the whole point of the book is to experience Della Fattoria breads at home. And, you know, in addition to what we've talked about, the progression from basic yeast all the way up to naturally fermented breads, there are also recipes in the book and that you've interwoven. They're your famous pot beans. And, again, you've woven these also with stories. There's a recipe in there that your grandson loves for a bean puree, I think. Mm-hmm. And so your grandkids are part of the story, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're our first food testers, right?
Yeah. And they live on the property.
They do. In fact, Jacob helped at Farmer's Market last Saturday. Helped at.
Oh, wow. Was that a first?
Yeah.
How'd he do, Ed? Very well. Well, that's darling.
You know, Kel, I do want to just say really quickly how hugely important Farmer's Market is to our business. You know, without Farmer's Market, we would, I don't even know where we would be. Because that whole, the vast number of people that we get to serve there, who've become our friends at this point, are the ones that follow us in our restaurant in Petaluma, who've bought our bread and told the story to so many others. And I dare say that it is the single most powerful promotional tool that we've used.
Well, I think farmers markets in general are having an incredible impact, not just on small business, but on culture.
On culture, absolutely. It's huge.
And lest you think that, you know, if you go to the farmers market and you've never been to Della Fattoria before and you think, oh, gosh, there's all these regulars and they won't want me. That's not true, because we have someone in the audience today who came to your stand for the first time this weekend. She's right there.
Oh, hi.
No. We'll come to it at the Q&A. We'll come to the Q&A about that. This is really cute. They had a great. I think they must have been served by your grandson, it sounds like. But a couple of other things, just to get back to the book for a minute, because there were a couple of other things that really jumped out at me that I want to ask you about, and one of them is so fundamental to the process. And yet, to me, it was revelatory. You say it's essential to understand flour and understand the freshness of flour. So could you describe for the home baker how they can tell if their flour is really fresh?
By the way, it goes through your fingers, I would say. When I first started baking bread, I was using gold medal off the shelf, like everybody does, and nothing, I don't want to get myself in trouble for naming a flour, but it was just that it was the commercial flour that was available, and it was pretty gray white and just didn't have any body to it that you could feel. But then my friend who has a restaurant ordered some flour, and I noticed that I could gather it in my hands and I could feel the moisture in it, and it just felt better, and it had an aroma. It smelled nutty and fresh. And you don't think about flour as having an aroma.
So you can actually take flour at home, your bread flour, and you squeeze it in your hand, and it'll just, if it's fresh, it'll actually just clump for a moment.
It will.
And if it's not, it'll just run through your hands like sawdust, right?
You know,
I did not know that.
I think, well, you know, that's my non-technical.
Well, we're talking non-technical
good.
Here,
this
right? Because
thing.
We're
that's
an old
thing.
Italian woman in a black
yeah,
dress.
That's
and
it.
Yeah,
and
that's how we talk.
And this Italian girl who's Irish and...
Yeah, Kathleen Webero. Okay, let's see. The other thing I think is really important in terms of success with the home bread baker is recommended right up in the front of the book in your very good equipment section is to use a scale.
Oh, boy. It's huge. And Bernadette, my chef friend, told me that too. She said, oh, don't be ridiculous. You can't go around measuring 12 cups of flour. It'll never turn out the same every time. And, of course, she's right. I mean, a scale is just, it's just the way to go. It's so much easier. It's accurate. And you'll find, if you go and scoop out a cup of white flour, that what they'll tell you in an equivalent scale is that that's going to be 5 ounces. Well, it might be, but it might not.
Right, depending on
and
who's scooping.
And you will see, it's on who's scooping, how you swipe it off, and what flour it is, and what time. I mean, all kinds of things can change that. So if you've got a scale, boy, you've just saved yourself a lot of grief.
And in your recipes, you use this really interesting format for the ingredients you call it a baker's box. So it's designed like you would communicate a recipe in a professional environment.
It's exactly the same way we do our recipes.
Okay.
That's what I started doing when I did our recipes for the first time, and so it's exactly the same formula that that we've used since the beginning.
And you give it in grams, ounces, and then by volume for those who, don't have a scale.
Right, in empirical, mm-hmm. but just because for some people they like to, that helps give them a visual, and I understand that. I think if you don't grasp that other, and until you, especially going into the grams and so forth, the metric, I don't think we as Americans have that visual yet of what 500 grams is, the way we do what 8 ounces or 5 ounces is. So I kind of wanted to have people start looking at all those things across and maybe starting to be able to perceive it in a more intuitive way.
So invest in a scale. They're not that expensive.
Not
They'll make
all.
Your
not
life
anymore.
So much easier. Yeah.
Right.
So then also in the book you give various tips and, there are inset boxes and there's this kind of ongoing series titled Courage in the Kitchen. And, you talk about all kinds of things in there, how to get it, make sure that bread doesn't stick to the proofing basket, how to test when bread is done, which why don't you just say how you test when bread is done? Because
well, the traditional test of turning the loaf over and tapping on the bottom is a great test still. Did I say anything different?
Yeah, no, you did. You also said in, so you want to...
You're looking at the color mm-hmm. and you're smelling for sure because you don't want it to go, you don't want it to burn on you before you get it done.
And for the very basic new cook, they can also insert an instant
read
thermometer,
yes,
like a roast.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, that was so interesting to me. And also, speaking of roast, not that we're talking about roast, we're talking about bread, but you also said something in there that, again, I just, after 25 years in this business, I did not know about bread, which is that like a roast, when you remove your bread from the oven, it continues to cook.
It does.
Yeah. And so as a result, you can leave it, you take it out, and you say you can leave it even overnight and slice it the next day, and it will be even better. So we don't have to have that fear of stale bread.
No. Well, certainly, if you try to slice it when it's warm, it's irresistible. We all do it. We do it in the bakery every night. but it's not, the French would be horrified. They would say it's going to give you terrible indigestion. Poulain doesn't let his bread go out until the next day. And we're a little bit like that. We bake our bread. We start baking at 3 in the afternoon and get through maybe 10 or 11 at night. And the first truck goes out at 1:30 or 2 in the morning. But it's cooled completely by that time. But yes, you don't have to worry about your bread going stale.
So we can bake the bread one day and then serve it the next, and no more
course.
Getting up at 3 a.m.
No more of that.
That's
no,
so nice.
No more of that.
One of the other things that caught my eye in the Courage is how to avoid baker's graves. Could you explain that?
Baker's grave is what happens when you put, as you're shaping the dough, if you get too much flour on this, on the outside of it, and you're rolling it up to shape it, that the purpose of the flour is to keep the dough from sticking to itself. So if you have a lot of flour on the inside, it's not going to stick to itself, and it's going to make a big hole.
So it's those holes that go
all. So the hole goes all the way through the bread from stem to stern, and that's called a baker's grave. It's a grave of shame because, you just must not use all this extra flour.
You even have a recipe in there that's made with wine in the bread. Well, there's one with wine grapes on the bread, on the
it's
dough.
The same one.
Oh, same one.
Same one.
So you're saying that the liquid can actually be replaced with other
some
than water?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you put wine in the... We how very idea. Sonoma County
but
of
I
you.
But I think it's... I don't think we invented that idea. I think the French do that at harvest. I think they take some of their newly bottled... wines.
Beaujolais or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that. But the first year that we did this, we use in, which, as you probably know, is very aromatic. And we were baking bread for Sonoma Mission Inn. We were baking those harvest loaves that you're talking about. So these loaves have wine on the inside, so it's about half wine and half water. And then before they go in a basket, they're topped with grape leaves and these little bundles of Zante currants or Pinot Noir grapes. So they're very tiny grapes. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, the aroma is out of this world. But we smelled far more like a winery than a bakery in those days. And, once those grapes get in the oven, they sort of caramelize and melt all over and make this unctuous, sweet, beautiful smell. And, you know, you can get that in your home kitchen.
That's the beauty of this book. And you can also get your signature bread in it, which is your Meyer lemon bread. And tell us how, because so many people have experienced that bread, and I don't think very many people know how it's made. I certainly didn't know. So just describe, it's similar to what you're talking about. There's dough, and then you do something to the top of it.
Right. So there's the dough, and you pre-shape it, and then you pat it out. So you've made this round, and then you pat the round out, and... then you take your slurry of rosemary, lemon zest, and olive oil, and you make a little well in the center of this little tapped out piece of dough, and you put it in there, and then you kind of work it around the rest of the top of the dough, and then you start shaping your dough so that ends up on the top, and you just barely see it through the surface.
Mm.
If it ends up all on the bottom, which sometimes it does, you know how annoying it is to see that rosemary bread all burned on the bottom. It's because the oil does kind of start to leak out, and of course it wants to burn. So that's all there is to it. Oh, and then before you put it in the oven, you give it the slash of the star, and then because that olive oil's there, those little points pop up and you get your crown.
People are groaning. No, far.
What do you want to go do?
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Kathleen Weber talk about her life and career. She is the founder of Della Fattoria in Petaluma. For the audience that's groaning, there is some bread here, and there is actually – so you're going to tell us what breads you have out there, but also there's a – some crackers, which is another one of the recipes in the book that caught my eye, was these cheddar crackers. So,
the crackers?
Yeah. And I ate one already.
Yeah, did you good?
They're very good.
Yeah.
What breads did you bring today?
We brought some of the rosemary. We brought some, and I do want to tell you this, there is some walnut bread in there. So if you're allergic, watch out that you don't get that. There's some semolina, some levain, and some cedar. I forget what the other one is.
There.
That one. It's a little guy. It was a baguette, so it's the one that'll have crust all the way around.
So we're passing around the breads right now for everybody to experience. We're going to transition to some question and answer in a minute, but before we do, Kathleen, I wanted to ask you if there's anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to add about your experience with the book or what's happening at Della Fattoria now or anything else you would like to share with us today.
You know, I think, Tori, the most important thing I'd like to share with everybody is that is what it is about bread. You know, there just is something about bread, and that's probably what has carried it through as part of a theme of my life. But it is the thing that's meant to share. And to me, having a community and having people sitting around a table with their elbows firmly, you know, planted, sort of transmitting some sort of energy from one person to the other while the bread goes around the table. Kind of what life's about, so
yeah, bread of life, exactly. Right. Alrighty, so now how unfair of me! I'm opening this up to questions, and everybody in the audience is chewing. So
it's okay to talk with food in your mouth. Here,
see,
though, isn't it?
Thank you, Kathleen says it's okay to talk with food in your mouth, which I would heartily endorse. So this is a great chance to tell Kathleen about your experiences with Della Fattoria bread or any bread. If you have questions, I know that she can answer specifically about her own recipes. And I know that our friend from the farmer's market is dying to tell her story. So should we start with you?
Okay.
Great.
I'm a newcomer to Della Fattoria bread, but I'm a regular at the Ferry Building Farmer's Market.
Okay.
And the week before last, somebody just mentioned the wonders of your Meyer lemon rosemary bread, and I couldn't get it out of my mind.
Oh,
so I clipped the page out, and I went to the market, and I didn't get to the booth until I had spent most of my cash. I bring just a certain amount of cash every week, otherwise I wouldn't be able to carry this stuff home. So anyway, I got to the Della Fattoria, and I asked if they had the bread, and he said, yes, they did. And I said, I'll take one. And I said, how much? And he said, $6. And I said, I only have five. And he said, I'll give it to you for five. And I said, no. I scrambled around in my pocket, and I found 55 cents. So I got this wonderful loaf of bread that I fed my family that very night, and without telling them that this was a new bread, that we were trying something really good. And every one of them commented on, what bread is this now? Where did you get this bread? So I feel like I made a wonderful discovery. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Letting me have that loaf.
Any other questions? Oh, come on. Yes, I knew. All it takes is the first one to go.
What I wonder, every time I go to the supermarket, there's racks and racks and rows of bread they call bread, and it's very poor. Why aren't commercial manufacturers turning out something that's better than the bread that I think I find on the shelves? They're so soft, there's nothing to them. And I think it's a very poor quality bread, and I just wonder why commercial manufacturers don't do a job, because I think most people would like a more substantial type bread.
That's a really good point. I think the American palate has wanted this soft bread for a long time, you know, and I don't think the manufacturers are ready to commit to the time and the he's looking for some rosemary bread, and we have some that we haven't put out yet. So
okay, we're
going to
replenish. Yes, we're
going
to.
We have a secret supply, and I'll make personally sure you get some.
Secret stash coming.
We won't let you go without it.
Right.
But
I'll just be eating some now.
So I guess I don't know exactly the answer to your question, except that there's a couple things that come to mind. One is that commercial flour is so much cheaper, and these big guys are definitely in the business of making money, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that you have to pay for the quality, you know, that's really the bottom line. And also with this, our bread is very hands-on. If you ever do come and watch my guys bake, And in the front of the book, you'll see the bakers. It's very, very intensely physical, and it's intensely hands-on. They are moving fast, and they're just doing an amazing job. But it's everybody's just not going to pay for that. It's a priority for you, obviously. I mean, I want to think it is.
Your breads would be impossible to reproduce, you know, in a non-human setting. It would be very, very difficult because a huge part of your writing in this book is about the intuition and the daily judgment of each batch of dough.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, and so a machine just really can't do that, right? This gentleman has a question. Hang on. Oh, sorry. We're going to have one question there, and then we'll come to you. She's got the microphone. Thank you.
So I'm you can call a new groupie for Kathleen. My husband and I have been digital nomads for the last 2 years, living all over the world, 2 months at a time, at every different country. In our last location, I met Kathleen not too long ago. We moved to Petaluma last February, and I discovered Della Fattoria. And we had just come back from Florence, from living there for a few months, where I desperately searched for the best bread. I'm a breadaholic, but I like only naturally living bread. I'm a complete snob when it comes to bread. And so I always look for the highest quality bread that, you know, my husband makes it. We have our own starter that we've developed and have been keeping for a long time. And so we know a lot about bread. We have our own wood fire oven. So we're very devoted to good bread. And so in Italy, I literally went searching for the best bread everywhere I could. I went to hundreds of bakeries probably. And I came to Petaluma, and to my delight, I discovered Della Fattoria, and I was just beside myself because it was such incredible bread. And I got to meet her, and I told her all about how in Florence I just went out of my way to find good bread, and they only had this, you know, Tuscan bread that was no flavor. They don't even add salt.
Saltless.
And it's made with yeast. And I'm sure that, you know, many decades ago that was not the case, but it's become industrialized, which is part of what the gentleman was referring to. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Kathleen's bread, you know, and I've tried all the good breads, you know, all the famous bakers. But I have to say that after living all over the world, Kathleen has by far the best bread.
Wow.
Wow. Thank you.
So in the book, there is a recipe for Pan Toscano, Tuscan bread. Oh, this gentleman here. And, of course, it's traditionally made without salt, but, in fact, you sneak a little salt in there.
We sneak a little salt in.
Mm-hmm. And you recommend it as a bread that's particularly good with food, which is really what the intention of Tuscan.
You're exactly right. That was because in that area they have the very salty meats and cheeses. And so the story they always tell, we have to go back on that. Yeah. I always wonder if, remember how salt used to be so revered and so expensive?
Right.
You know, there's a part of me that thinks it was the frugality that had them leave the salt out.
Well, there's always been a myth that there was a tax on salt, and so therefore they just said, forget it, we just won't put it in. But I don't know that that's true.
I'm not sure either, Tori. Yeah. I don't know. Because what they always say is it's because it's to allow for the very salty meats and to create balance. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So your Pan Toscano, no doubt, is way better than anything in Toscana. Well, sorry, I love Italy.
No, exactly. We have a farmer's market customer, a very beloved customer, who is from Tuscany. And she just craves that flavor of the bread without the salt. And she begs Ed all the time. She said, please have Kathleen make one without salt.
Have you done it?
Yes, but I didn't send it to her, but I will.
Now, this gentleman is waiting here with his microphone.
A couple of comments. There's this thing called Skinny Dipper crackers.
Huh.
You don't know about them?
No.
Osory Bakery, I think it's in Canada. Very interesting cracker. I just wondered if you made something like that.
Huh.
Evidently, well, you don't know. Maybe you do.
Well, maybe I do, and I don't know what it is.
Right. They're a lot of fun. And Whole Foods has a lot of different flours.
Yes.
Do you use a variety of those kinds of flowers? And
yes.
I'm not a bread eater. I quit eating bread years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But having tasted some of your bread, I might indulge.
Well, wait till you have the Meyer lemon rosemary one that you're waiting
for.
Yeah,
after that, the lemon bread. So anyway, we'll talk later about something.
Yeah, I want to know what those skinny crackers
are. Different thing.
The skinny dip crackers?
So the crackers are coming around, and that is a recipe from the book.
Right, and these have a little heat in them, so they're spicy.
From, what's the heat from?
With chilies.
Little cayenne?
Little chili peppers in there.
Mm, super. The lady in the green coat would like to ask a question.
So I'm fascinated about the self-leavening bread.
Yeah.
I just heard a piece on NPR last Friday on the Science Times show about how every human being has a natural biome, like a fingerprint, and they're now thinking about using the bacteria that you slough off or that you create in your living environment forensically, and that you can trace that with a person only being in a room for 15, 20 minutes, an hour or so. And it's fascinating to hear that your take on that from a bread-making standpoint, that it's your own, you know, your own fingerprint, your own biological fingerprint is sort of the bacteria that live on your skin, that you slough off and all that. Because I took a kimchi making class once.
Oh.
And the woman leading it said, don't wash your hands, just crunch the cabbage and the peppers and everything else with some salt and pack it as, you know, after you've tossed it fully with your hands. Because it's going to be the lactic acid and the bacteria on your skin that creates the fermentation process.
So it's on your skin, but it's also what's in your room.
It's also in the ambient environment.
Like from whatever cheeses you eat, whatever whatever of that is around.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you just discover that on your own, or is that something that you learned in making the bread? Or
the
I'm
first
just
time
find
I tried
it fascinating.
It, the first time I tried it, it was like a religious moment for me, because I went from having my natural starter but putting a little bit of yeast in it to, okay, today I'm going to do it. I'm not going to put any yeast in, none. And then I would just maybe take two little pieces between my fingers and put them in. And then, you know, and then finally this one day, but at this point I was selling the bread, so I couldn't afford to have it fail. This was way back in the early 90s. So I just remember standing in front of the bowl going, okay, today's the day. Nothing. You're on your own. You are on your own. Please be bread. Please be bread. And it was. But, you know, it was the most giant leap of faith ever, really. Because it didn't make sense to me. How could this possibly work? Well, of course, you know, now because we've got our Chad Robertsons who... And Harold McGee's and these people that are so smart about all this, we know we have the answers to it. But I didn't then.
Yeah, I think I heard that report as well, and I had the same thought that, you know, it seems like magic. There is science behind it. I like to just think of it as magic. I go with magic.
Strong.
We have time for about one more question. Oh, this gentleman here? Hang on, Gail's got it. Sorry. We have time for two more questions. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Oh,
yeah.
Well, okay. My question mostly focuses on the growth of the business.
Yeah.
And then I know you have multiple, you have different areas now, and just some of the decision making that went on as you either opened the cafe or joined the farmers market, or just, you know, what are some of the decisions that you were making, both easy and tough?
Are you asking for business advice?
I happen to have a little farm myself, so I'm in a lot of, I'm constantly making decisions. But anyway, I'm just curious what some of your processes were.
I think a lot of it just evolved, to be quite honest. You know, as the business grew, they're just other people kind of told us what they wanted from us. The cafe was mainly, the farmers market was a very coveted thing. We'd been to the farmers market on Green Street, and it was such a charming, fabulous thing. We really, really wanted to be part of that. And Peggy Knickerbocker, who's now a good friend of mine, helped us get into that market. And so that was just almost a greedy decision. But then the other part is once we started dealing with our customers, we found it much more satisfying to be able to hand our loaf of bread that we made to a customer that was going to go home and put it on his or her table. That exchange is way more powerful than I could ever describe to you. You know, there was this thing when I was baking mainly for restaurants where I would be in there by myself at 2 a.m. listening to NPR going, who is going to be eating this bread tonight? Whose plate is this going to be on? And I'm not making this up. I really did think about that. So to have that knowledge was just kind of a gift for us. It was very satisfying. So that was that kind of a decision. Then at one point, we'd worked hard long enough that we took a little trip to Italy and just had a marvelous, marvelous time. But we really did see these little gathering spots where people would go and you know how charming they are in Italy. They hold hands going down the street. They stand on the corner and talk together. They go in the cafe. They have they throw back their espresso. But there's always this chattering that's happening and a place to just be. And I think that we wanted to create such a place where people would come and be very, very comfortable. So that was the evolution of the cafe. And the next step, you know, we don't know.
Okay. A cookbook. The next step was
cookbook.
A cookbook.
Yes, well, that was, yeah. Yes. Well, we do. On the ranch, we do have people. We do have, we have three little houses where people can rent. It's kind of the agritourism thing. And for those people, we provide eggs from our chickens, fresh bread, and then coffee from our Petaluma Coffee Company. So we don't serve you breakfast, although someone did knock on my door one Sunday morning waiting for her mimosa. That was a more unusual request. I think we maybe were able to put it together for her.
All right, this gentleman here has a question.
It's a little too close. So I've been a Della fan for quite a while now, I think.
Oh, he's using the nickname.
Getting more, probably more and more of a fan as we go. I was wondering, as someone that's sort of watching and has seen you, and you sort of have this amazing experience that you provide, an amazing product, and for maybe someone that's younger or starting a new thing at any age, if you have any little nugget of advice for how to maybe stay invested in what you believe in, create a product that's something that's
wow.
close to your heart, and still have these real connections with people, and still be able to sustain it, and be someone who's happy and busy, and not in too much pain in other ways, but like you're sustaining yourself, and still, I mean, like what's been discussed about the industrialization of this exact product that you're
right.
providing, I wouldn't say an alternative, but you're providing this amazing thing, and people respond to that because of what it is. And if you have any, like, I know it's tough, but like a little nugget?
Well, a little nugget would be that without authenticity, you aren't going to have an audience. So whatever it is you do, if it's something that's really true to yourself and it's from you and it's an expression of who you are, I believe it will be well received. And it may not be the first moment that happens, but it will come around. There's always a way to make a living. I've done a lot of things in my life before I did this. And somehow they've all made an appearance.
So on that note, I'm going to read a little quote from Kathleen's book that I think is another nugget. And she writes, "Generosity is the common language of good cooks and bakers." And I think it might also be the common language of those who are successful in doing what they love. I added those words.
You did.
I did.
And that was, and I approved.
But we're together on this. So thank you, Kathleen Weber, for sharing your generosity with us here today and your bread. And the book will be available for signing afterwards. And thank you for all the delicious bread that you have served us through the years. And we also thank our audience here, as well as those listening in on the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.